oh my goodness, we've had an incident occur, and now what do we do? Like, what are you seeing out there?
You know, truth be told, it really is a mixed bag. One of our clients got a call from one of their customers to say, hey client, your website we think has been hacked. We think you should do something about it. In kind of the incidents that I've handled, oftentimes there's situations where the victim doesn't even know the incident is occurring. You know, some are comfortable with just sort of cursory information, and others really want to do an in-depth assessment of your security posture. And, you know, if you're on the receiving end of one of those in-depth questionnaires as a company, you want to make sure you are candid and forthcoming on those things.
I'm Rob Samopoulos, and welcome to another episode of The Hilt. Today, I'm chatting with Sid Bose from Ice Miller. I've known Sid for a number of years and love hearing his stories. Here's the neat thing about Sid. Today, he's an attorney at Ice Miller and works with customers on data security and privacy and all that fun stuff. But really, his background is in IT. In his former life, he was an IT performance engineer. So wait until you really hear his perspective on things. I always enjoy the conversation. I'm really excited to jump in here. So let's get started.
Awesome. Well, thanks for the opportunity to speak with you. So my name is Sid Bose. I am an attorney with Ice Miller, a firm out here in Indianapolis, actually. And I work for our firm's data security and privacy group. So prior to becoming an attorney, this is about 5 years ago, I actually was an IT professional. I used to be a systems engineer for almost 9 years. And then I came over to the other dark side and became a data security and privacy attorney. So our firm's a general practice firm. We cover a lot of areas, and I focus heavily on data security and privacy for the most part.
And so, Sid, that's so interesting. I think that's a pretty rare path. So you were in IT, and then you went and studied law, and now you practice law in a full-time capacity. Is that right? Is that what you said?
That's exactly right. It was sort of an odd roadmap for my career so far. I did school and engineering, and I always thought I'd stay in the IT sector. And then, you know, things happened. And before you know it, I was doing law school part-time and made my way through. And lo and behold, there's all of a sudden a burgeoning area for data security and privacy. And I thought, why not give it a hand there? And so here I ended up with being a data security and privacy attorney.
That's awesome. And so with that background, that's so valuable. So for the people who are listening, you know, help us understand, what's the relationship between a law firm and cybersecurity or privacy? Like, how do they go hand in hand? I don't think everybody understands that there's a relationship there.
You know, it's a great point you make. It is oftentimes something that's not in the forefront of people's minds when they think of cybersecurity and when they think of attorneys. But you really, when you actually get to the nuts and bolts of it, attorneys, you know, setting the shameless plug aside, attorneys are essential to a lot of companies' cybersecurity programs. You know, let's take a quick and simple example. Let's say there's an incident response going on. You know, let's say you have a data breach or something to that effect. One of the core roles that an attorney plays is sort of advising you on what your obligations are. For example, if there's a loss of personal information, for example, understanding what the responsibilities of the company are as far as, for example, notifying individuals, when to notify, what the notification should include. Some states, for example, have specific requirements like credit monitoring that you have to provide. You know, understanding those types of requirements, that's one aspect. And lately, we've also seen a lot more moving away from the data breach side and just general overall compliance, especially on the privacy side. We see a lot of new regulation coming along, and a lot of companies need to be aware of what their obligations are. And that's where I think, you know, having an attorney that focuses on cybersecurity and has a traditional IT background is really beneficial, because then they get to bring to the table both sides of the coin, if you will.
Oh, I agree with you. So Sid, when do these engagements usually start? Are you seeing people being proactive and sort of getting these arrangements in place ahead of time? Or is it sort of a reactive thing where, oh my goodness, we've had an incident occur, and now what do we do? Like, what are you seeing out there?
You know, truth be told, it really is a mixed bag. You know, there have been many times when we got a call from a client. I got a great one. The client, one of our clients, got a call from one of their customers to say, hey, client, your website, we think has been hacked. We think you should do something about it. And then the client engaged us, and then we came to find out, yes, you know, it was true. So for a long time, they actually didn't even know that their website was hacked. And they had to get that information from one of their customers, which is not a good position to be in.
Right.
And so, yes, we do get a lot of times the first call we get from companies is that initial reaction or that little firefight where they think there's an event going on or some sort of security incident. And then when they call us, but more so, we're also moving towards a lot of companies taking a proactive step where they do want to get ahead. And, you know, they start engaging counsel ahead of time to understand where their risks are, what they need to be doing, how best to go about doing that. So it really is a mixed bag. And all I can say is, you know, try to get ahead of it and, you know, start engaging with attorneys to talk about what all the issues that you could potentially face and how best to go about handling that.
Yeah, that's great. You mentioned breaches of websites a couple times since we started talking. And, you know, it just seems like every day in the news, we're reading about a new breach of a website, And so many this year, some massive ones. One that comes to mind is the Marriott breach. I think there were like 500 million customers affected and even, you know, millions of unencrypted password numbers, you know, stolen. And when they finished the, I guess, the deep dive there, they realized that, yeah, there was a remote access Trojan on the network, or I guess it's that's where everyone's sort of pointing to at this point in time. And that, you know, that's how the attackers got in. So, you know, that's a massive breach, 500 million people. And then the one that I think is really interesting that sort of ties into the legal side of things is the Delta Airlines situation, where they have a chatbot vendor who, I guess, just declared that they recognized that they had a breach of their system, which exposed a whole bunch of customer information of Delta's names, contact numbers, email addresses, and so forth. And now there's a lawsuit going down. Have you seen any incidents similar to that where, you know, a breach of website is causing people to take legal action? And especially when we're talking about these third-party tools and solutions and so forth, I think it's really interesting. Any thoughts on that, Sid?
You know, I think the Delta and Marriott cases, they really teach a lot of good lessons learned if you go through them. You know, we'll start with the Marriott one, for example. You know, that one was in some aspects an acquisition of the Starwoods program. And throughout that process, you know, you can make a case that there should have been a little bit more due diligence going on when you sort of engage or looking into partnerships with third parties. On the Delta side, one of the big takeaways there is, you know, understanding the vendors that you work with. Oftentimes, there's sort of a black box mentality, if you will, when companies hire outside parties or third parties vendors, thinking that, you know, by outsourcing that or using a third party provider for those services, they can sort of take the approach of, okay, it's covered under that third party, I don't have to care about it. But really what we're seeing is that, you know, there is a requirement, or not a requirement, let's say, there is an onus on a company to sort of look underneath the covers, open up the black box, and actually pay attention to what their third parties are doing, how they're doing it. So in the case of Delta Airlines, for example, you know, what they came to find out was their vendor had known about the data breach for about 6 months, had very lax security practices. For example, they were sharing user credentials across multiple people. And so those types of things came to light. And, you know, it begs the question, one of those things is, you know, if how much diligence went into, you know, that relationship with that vendor, and what can companies be doing going forward when they do engage third-party providers? And I think those are important takeaways, which is to say, you know, don't think of it as a black box. Make sure you look underneath the covers. Ask questions. A lot of times, you know, you can get a sense for how your vendor operates just by asking a couple of basic threshold questions, and from there, try to make a more informed decision.
Oh yeah, we're seeing a huge increase in the number of third-party vendor assessments of organizations, especially from enterprise entities who are realizing that their providers are are definitely a threat, and that they want to look under the hood and understand what their cybersecurity hygiene and posture looks like. You know, and these, we've actually spoken to a lot of small businesses who, you know, do business with these enterprise organizations, are getting 200, you know, questionnaires sent to them, you know, asking them all kinds of questions about policies, plans, training, you know, what kind of technology do you have in place? It sounds like you agree that that's an important process so that, you know, those organizations can protect themselves.
Oh, absolutely. I think the old way of doing it, and I think, you know, thinking back to the early Target data breach days, oh, everybody knows Target's name, but don't realize that it was, you know, one of the suspected HVAC contractors that was likely source of compromise. And, you know, starting then on, it really underscores the need to be able to make sure you understand who you are giving keys to the kingdoms to. You know, if you have a vendor that has access into your environment, you want to make sure that they are doing all the right things when it comes to security, that they do have good controls in place, that they do have best practices enforced. And so it's all the more important nowadays to just go ahead and do that due diligence and do it the right way, because you really just can't turn a blind eye anymore.
Sid, I think that's a really great point. Think about all these providers and the remote access they have to these networks. Because you mentioned the HVAC provider at Target, but we've got systems contractors who install cameras, access control, audiovisual systems who are now remoting into their customers' sites and providing, you know, remote support. Recently, there's been a lot of news going on about IT providers who have remote access into their customers' networks, and that attackers have actually got into their networks and then pivoted into their customers' networks, and from there actually dropped ransomware and made some attacks, some successful attacks, which have been devastating. I think your point's very valid in regards to that. You know, I guess the third-party vendor assessment, again, it's a very, very important step that an organization needs to take.
So, I think we're on the same page there. Absolutely agree. And you know, one of the concerns when I talk to my clients, you know, when I tell them, you know, how do you have oversight over your third-party providers? You know, a common answer, and it's very understandable, is that, you know, I really don't have the time to have oversight over my vendors or my third-party providers. You know, I got to run my business. You know, that's the answer I get. And, you know, I understand why they say that. But I think there's a couple of options there, you know, making sure, for example, the vendor independently goes through an independent audit, for example. You know, those are other alternate recourse mechanisms that are available. But you have to make sure those provisions are in place in your agreement with those vendors. Otherwise, you know, you really do risk the chance of them running wild and having whatever controls they have without meeting adequate requirements.
Right. You mentioned in the Delta breach that it took them 6 months to you know, provide notification that a breach actually occurred. And, you know, there's been incidents that have occurred where, you know, it takes a year before any notification's given out. Why is there such a gap there? Is that because the organization is working with legal to understand, you know, what the steps are that they need to take and before they provide their response? What are your thoughts on that, Sid?
Well, you know, in kind of the incidents that I've handled, oftentimes there's situations where the victim doesn't even know the incident is occurring. They get a knock on the door, maybe from law enforcement, or in the example that I provided earlier, our client got a call from one of their customers saying, hey, we think you should review your website. We found a remote call to this malicious site. We think there might be an issue. And so a lot of times they just don't know, you know, that it's happening. And they really have to, they don't rely on it, but they come to find out from a third party, and that's certainly not a position. And the other aspect of it is, you know, incident response and sort of the investigation sometimes just takes a long time.
Right.
And unfortunately, you know, there's sort of a requirement, if you will, that we have to move faster. Kind of going off on a bit of a tangent here, if you look at the GDPR, which is a privacy regulation coming out of the European Union, there you have to make certain notifications within 72 hours. And if any company has ever been in an incident response, been in that firefight, they know that 72 hours is not a lot of time to sort of get your ducks in a row to be able to have a full comprehension of the scope of the incident. And so it's all the more important for companies to really have a good incident response in place to sort of be able to navigate the complexities and the difficulties of such a firefight and go about making sure they meet all the necessary timelines. A good example, we had a client that had an incident, and you know, one of the questions we asked them is, well, tell us all about the agreements that you have in place with your customers and what those agreements say as far as notification. And we got a blank stare because it was not something they'd ever considered. A couple of prongs. One, making sure you meet all the regulations and laws in place, and also meet any of your commitments to your customers that you have in place as well in terms of agreements that you've signed.
Oh, I see what you're saying. So actually in the agreement saying that you must provide us notification by a certain period of time if you suspect a breach of our sensitive data that you're storing, that makes a lot of sense. You're seeing that increasing in these agreements now?
Absolutely. I think, you know, it's sort of expanding. Traditionally, we would see that in a security-centric agreement, but in larger, broader agreements, general agreements right now, we see obligations around data breaches and incident response and security incidents. For example, notification timelines. I see some clients ask as little as 24 hours before they have to notify. And so it really is coming to the forefront right now. And, you know, if you're on the receiving end of those commitments or those obligations, you have to make sure that you have a good incident response in place that sort of can meet those timelines, because otherwise you might be in violation of your obligations.
Right, right. So an interesting thing as well is that, you know, a lot of organizations are, I don't want to use the word crutch, but they're basically utilizing cybersecurity insurance as they're really almost as their protection level, meaning that they're not really doing a lot of things on the front end to get themselves protected, but rather, you know, using cybersecurity as insurance as sort of their fallback. So if something happens, we have a major breach of our customers' data, we have a website breach, it's okay, I have cybersecurity insurance in place. But what we're also seeing is that some of these claims are starting to be denied now. So an interesting one is with the ransomware attack that happened and the U.S. snack food giant Mondelez, you know, they had $100 million claim with their cyber insurance provider and they denied it. They said that it was an act of war and that they weren't going to pay that claim. Have you seen anything happening like that on the legal side?
You know, it's funny you mentioned that. I was just working on a cyber insurance claim for a client, and I have a partner that I work heavily on all my cyber insurance requests, and he always says companies go about buying cyber insurance the way people who don't know anything about wine buy wine at a restaurant. They don't want to look cheap, so they don't go with the cheapest option, and they certainly can't afford the most expensive option, so they just kind of go with the in-between option. And I think that really is symptomatic of the nature of cyber insurance right now, which is sort of the wild, wild west. You know, it's important when companies go about buying cyber insurance, they actually understand what type of coverages they are buying, what types of incidents are covered as far as the policy goes. Because there's a lot of exclusions and there's a lot of language in there that can be very confusing. And until a company actually sits down with, you know, their insurance provider and also an attorney to help understand what that language actually means, they might be in a position where they, if and when they come to file a claim, they find out that the claim is not covered. And I think that's one of the things that you're seeing with a lot of these, petty attacks, which I think is a company, Mondelez had, the ransomware incident the Mondelez had. And in that case, I think the insurance provider, they said, you know, it's an act of war and that's not covered in our policy. Again, kind of underscoring the need to actually make sure you understand what it is you're buying when you do get a policy in place, and having to make sure you have the right coverages based on the risks that you see for your company and for your customers, the types of data that you have.
It does have a Wild West feel to it, because these applications that people are filling in to get their cyber insurance, you know, some of them just say, you know, how many employees do you have? How long have you been in business? What's your revenue? And then other ones get really detailed, you know, detailed assessments on technology, policies, plans, all those important things that are in place. I agree with you. I think that it's all over the place. I don't know how you give someone a proper cyber insurance coverage, or, you know, with just knowing what their revenue and employee count is, but yeah, really interesting.
You know, it's a great point you bring up, and I think it just really is underscores the variation you see across companies and underwriters when it comes to issuing policies. You know, some are comfortable with just sort of cursory information, and others really want to do an in-depth assessment of your security posture And, you know, if you're on the receiving end of one of those in-depth questionnaires as a company, you want to make sure you are candid and forthcoming on those things. Because the last thing you want to do is make some sort of representation or some sort of statement on those responses that turns out is not valid. And that also could be a basis for a claim denial down the road.
Absolutely. And I think along those same lines, I'm sure you would support the same initiative in regards to these third-party vendor assessments. You know, these small businesses getting those questionnaires from their customers that, you know, are asking, do you have all these things in place? I think it's really important that these small business operators understand that when they answer those questions, they have to answer them, you know, appropriately for a couple of reasons. One is you don't want to lose the customer because you don't have those things in place. But number two is answer it accurately so that if something does happen, you know, it can't be turned around and basically you're used against you in saying that you represented that you have all these things in place, but you don't. That could definitely put you into a difficult legal position.
You know what, Rob, you hit it right on the head there. And I think there's a big concern, especially with the smaller companies. They want to make sure that they present themselves in the best light possible. So, you know, while some of them don't, I won't go so far as to say they lie on those responses, but there's sort of a desire to make themselves look good. And, you know, and that's understandable. As a small company, you want to put your best foot forward, but you also have to make sure that you're making the right representations on there. And you don't want to lose the client, obviously, but that doesn't mean it's the end all and be all, right? A lot of times it's the questionnaire responses are just a start to having a conversation. And if the client comes back or if the prospective client comes back and asks you additional questions, that's not necessarily a bad thing. It just probably means that you have to take the additional steps to sort of convey your security posture and get them to buy in that way. So yeah, small businesses, when they're given these responses, they want to be cognizant of what it is they're putting on paper, because that's very important.
Absolutely. Sid, let's talk about one of your favorite topics, IoT devices. So Internet of Things, you know, we're hooking everything up to our networks, in our homes, in our businesses. You know, I think you agree with me that there is some major differences between some of these devices that people are buying. You know, some of them are security first focused. Other ones are, you know, security last, and let's make it as inexpensive as we can and get it to market. And then with that, you know, we have this vulnerability problem where, first off, a vulnerability needs to be identified. And second off, because attackers will utilize those vulnerabilities to, you know, cause these attacks. But the other part of it is that if a vulnerability is discovered by the manufacturer, how quickly can they get that patched? And then the last part is, you know, does the consumer, the person buying it, know about that this device needs to be updated and patched? It's a crazy world, isn't it?
It is. I mean, I think we've had plenty of conversations on the complexities of IoT, and it just seems to get more and more daunting as each day progresses. And you're absolutely right. There's a lot of dimensions to security and privacy as well, especially in the IoT space. And we're seeing a lot of changes. You know, take California, for example. They passed a law that requires a lot of security measures in IoT devices, and that goes into effect in 2020. So for companies that are in this space, there's not a lot of time for sort of to implement the security measures to meet the requirements of that California law. And so that's one example. So, there's a lot of change going on in the IoT space, especially around these connected devices. And so it's really an interesting time there.
So does that mean that if a device is sold in the state of California, they have to meet specific criteria on the way that device has security settings, like default passwords?
So it's the California law, it calls it reasonable security features. And working in the security field, I think you can appreciate the vagueness of that statement and how hard it is to sort of put a box around what those requirements are. But I think that to some extent it is, that's sort of what you have to do in this space, because there's so much evolution and so much fast-paced change in here that the moment you start to put prescriptive requirements, it could get outdated by the time the law gets issued. But I think if you look at what between California's IoT law and even the FTC, for example, put out a publication a few years ago. They called it Careful Connections, Building Security in the Internet of Things. And there's a lot of general guidelines on what security looks like, and they lay it out as fundamentals. You know, think about things like a culture of security, encouraging a culture of security at your company, implementing security by design. You know, the thought is that, you know, oftentimes a lot of IoT manufacturers want to be the first on the market, and, you know, they're asking for a change of that mindset to being the most secure on the market. You know, taking a defense in depth approach. And I think the one of the most important ones is sort of the risk-based approach. You know, if you're a manufacturer of, let's say, a light bulb, you might have different risk considerations than, let's say, the lock and key manufacturer or a smart lock manufacturer. So I think those are important considerations for any manufacturer of these IoT devices. It's sort of a, take a risk-based approach. And, you know, you'll come to find out as you look through the California regulation and the FTC guidance, a lot of this work has already sort of been done in other spaces commonly found in cybersecurity or just general data security. You know, things like default passwords, you know, being able to change default passwords. That's not mind-blowingly new. It's something that's been around for a long time. I think it's just being adopted over into the IoT space.
Right. So, you know, California's taking those steps. What else can we expect on the state and federal side? I know that other states have started passing cybersecurity regulations. What are you seeing there that you can share?
You know, I think what we're going to start to see, you know, especially, and we've already seen some of it, is an increasing focus on security and privacy from a lot of different state legislatures and a lot of state governments. I think we're, you know, part of the impetus for that is there's really no sort of a federal direction as far as security goes. And so a lot of the states are sort of taking it upon themselves to issue these new laws and regulations that are directed at security and privacy. And so where I think companies can expect us to start to see more and more of these coming down the pipe, and they really need to start paying attention to ensuring, you know, there's good security practices, good privacy practices in how they operate, the devices that they produce and manufacture. It is going to be a core consideration and a core competency that they have to develop as part of their, you know, it's a product pipeline or sort of the services that they offer.
Right. So, you know, I feel like we're starting to see an increase in lawsuits surrounding cybersecurity incidents, and we're probably just starting to, you know, scratch the surface. Do you expect that this is going to become more and more of a thing that we're going to see here where, you know, if someone has a breach or someone states that they have things in place, but they really don't, that we're going to see a continued increase there?
You know, I think so. I think especially, and when we'll go back to California, you know, California has a California Consumer Privacy Act. And one of the unique things about that is it allows for a private right of action. And what that means is that, you know, you can have individuals file suits against companies for a private cause of action as a result of a data breach. And so what a lot of companies, what I foresee, again, different lawyers might have different opinions here, but I think what you're going to see is, you know, as companies, you know, provide notification to individuals on data breaches, you can expect to see a lot more lawsuits coming out of it and, you know, a lot more individuals making claims against these companies that they were impacted by as a result of these lawsuits. And that's definitely a reality that could come to fruition in the next 18 months or so.
Well, I think it makes total sense because it can be devastating to an individual or a business in the same regards when these things do happen. All right, I have a last question for you. We know enterprise organizations are spending a lot of money protecting themselves from cybersecurity, you know, threats and, you know, implementing technologies and plans and so on. And small businesses are starting to recognize that this is important to them too, whether they're just reading in their trade magazine or, you know, they're hearing about their friend's business having an incident there. What would you recommend to a small business operator today? What should they do? Where should they really begin in order to get their cybersecurity in place and get things rolling? What are your thoughts there?
You know, that's a great question. And I have a lot of small business clients and a lot of startup clients who always ask, you know, it seems like cybersecurity is such an expensive proposition. And, you know, I really don't have the money to invest in this right now. And you know, what I usually tell them is, you know, this is not about boiling the ocean. This is not about being perfect right off the bat. A lot of it is, you know, sort of doing the right things in the course of a long road ahead. And you can take small steps to sort of secure yourself in a lot of different ways that are not a significant cost consideration in the grand scheme of things. Obviously, if you're a small mom and pop organization, by no means do I think you should have the best of breed security tools or an enterprise solution. All I ask is that you sort of take a risk-based approach to see what is appropriate for your organization. You know, look at the types of data you have, look at the types of customers you have, look at what your personnel do. You know, ask those sort of initial threshold questions, and there you'll come to find out that, you know, you can break it apart into smaller pieces, and cybersecurity all of a sudden is not sort of this behemoth that you have to tackle, but it really can be little things here and there that go a long way.
I think that's great recommendation. And here we talk a lot about that cybersecurity is not a project. It's not something you do once. It's really a program that's always improving. So you're right. Just take some steps, start getting things going, and it's always going to improve as you continue to develop on that program. Sid, this is excellent. I really appreciate you joining me, and thanks so much.
Hey, thanks a lot for having me. Really appreciate the opportunity to chat with you. Really good time.
Thanks, Sid.